originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I'm joining you tonight from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio. I'd like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219, XM 201, and also to those of you tuning into our website at www.horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. If you are able to help, please visit their website at www.pdjf.org. So our guest this evening, at the age of 57, he is still going strong, having won 9 leading rider titles at Turf Paradise, 3 at Canterbury Park, and also Sacramento, Stockton, and La Boy Park. He won the Grade 3 Manitoba Derby, the Grade 3 Phoenix Gold Cup, with 4,815 total wins and over $40 million in earnings. It is a pleasure to introduce jockey Scott Stevens. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Such a pleasure to get you on here, Scott. I can't wait to hear your story. Tell us where you're at right now.
I'm back home in Phoenix. I got back a week ago today, actually, from Minnesota.
So you were riding at Canterbury Park during the summer?
What I did, I did it the last 3 years. When Turf Paradise is over, I take a break. I go to Idaho and see my parents. I got a daughter that lives in Oregon, and I get in the motorhome and drive. And then I get phone calls of people want me to come and ride stakes. And it's worked out real good for the last 3 summers. I ended up, I rode at Arapaho Park in Denver. I would fly out of here on Sunday morning and be back in my bed in Phoenix Sunday night. I think I rode 21 horses at Arapaho through the summer, and I won 9, and 7 of them were stakes. And, yeah, the last trip that I made, which was the 12th of August, I went ahead and took the motorhome up there and then drove to Canterbury and rode there the last month. So I'm on vacation.
Yeah, vacation. Can't beat that. You take a motorhome all over. That's wild. That's brave. I don't know if I'd want to drive one of those on the road.
Well, I only took the motorhome on the last trip. Okay. I flew, you know, through the summer I would fly. But the motorhome, it works good for my trip to Idaho and up the California coast into Oregon and then up at Canterbury, obviously, the last month. It's good to have a place to stay. So
makes sense. And you were born in Idaho then. And,
right.
And your dad was a trainer, correct?
Yes, my dad, he trained from, you know, the time I put part-time, you know, he had a full-time job, but he also, you know, trained horses on the, and that's how we spent our summers. And, you know, me and Gary both grew up with horses in our backyard. And, I mean, that's all I ever wanted to do. And I was fortunate to, it's the only job I've ever had since I was 15, so.
As you mentioned, your younger brother, Gary, we've had Gary on the show, of course, and you both have just had such great success. Now, I guess since you're the older brother, I guess, was it your idea first to start riding?
Yeah, I rode 2.5 years before he did. I was a good coach, I think, because he turned out to be a great rider.
I would say so, definitely. And as you mentioned, there was never any doubt in your mind what you wanted to do.
No, I started writing when I was 15. I had a fake birth certificate and lied about my age and started a year early because I was afraid I was going to get too big. And I think I must have stunted my growth because I didn't grow much after that.
Did they ever catch that, a fake birth?
They did catch me. They caught me 5 years later, and I got fined. I was a little worried about it because I'd rode at the time. I think I'd rode in 4 different states, so I thought I might be in trouble in all of them. But they took the one from Idaho, and I think I got fined $500 and a year's probation. So
you weren't able to ride during that year?
No, I was able to ride.
Okay.
I was able to ride.
Well, that's good. So I guess it wasn't such a bad deal then.
No, it wasn't a bad deal.
And so did you start riding there in Idaho?
Yes. Yep. We had there's a little fair meet in Emmett, Idaho that was just quarter horses. And that's where I actually rode my first race, which they only run 3 weekends. And then Boise started and things started rolling after that. I was leading rider there. I rode there 7 years, and I was leading rider all but the first year I rode. So,
pretty impressive. Now, who during those early years, who would you say helped you out in the beginning, taught you the ropes?
Well, I was very fortunate that Taylor Powell was the guild represent for the West Coast, and he actually lived about 2 miles from me. So he was very inspirational in helping me when I first started. And then there were several riders in Boise. You know, they're not big-name riders by any means, but they could ride. And one of them in particular, his name was Kent Story. He gave me my first helmet, gave me my first saddle. And, you know, they were riding my dad's horses, and they knew I wanted to be a jockey. So, I mean, I started galloping horses when I was, like, 11 years old.
Wow. So it probably came pretty natural to you since you started out at such a young age.
Yeah. I mean, I lived on a horse from when I was, when my brothers were off riding bicycles, I was riding the horses, so.
So you have more than one brother then, more than just
Yeah,
Gary?
I have a brother a year older than me, Craig. And he's involved. He owns a few horses, and his son's actually training now. Satchel's his name, my nephew.
But I guess Craig never had any desire to actually ride like you and Gary.
No, he liked the races. He was a gambler, so. But now they have some brood mares and they're raising some horses, so.
So we talked about how it came pretty natural to you since you galloped horses since the age of 11. But during your time in school, were you athletic? Did you play sports?
I wrestled. I played football all through junior high when they had heavyweights and lightweights. So when we got to high school, I went out for the football team and realized after the second day they were way too big for me. I think I only weighed like 89 pounds. So that didn't last long. But I wrestled all through high school, which I quit and took the GED. I had about a month left of my junior year.
So you were able to get your GED then before you actually started to ride?
No, I was already riding because started riding. Yeah, I mean I was 15 when I was riding.
Wow.
So
that's right. So,
First year that I rode, I just rode for the 3 months in Boise, and then I went back to school and got an extension on my bug. And at that time, I would ride in Boise, and then the second year, I think I went to Playfair after Boise was over, which was in Spokane, Washington. And then the next 2 years, I went to Centennial in Denver. They had a mixed meet that would start right after Boise. Because when I first started, I rode quarter horses just as much as I did thoroughbreds. The stats, they've missed some of my stats on Equibase for the quarter horses. They don't have any of my ones in the 80s when I was riding, but I probably won 600-700 quarter horse races.
Wow. Now, how is that different, Scott, between riding a thoroughbred and a quarter horse? Obviously, quarter horses are faster for a shorter distance, but tell us, riding-wise, how is it different for you?
the main thing with a quarter horse is in my you got, you know, if you don't break, you're pretty much screwed. But you know, growing up, I mean, the first race I rode was on a quarter horse, so it's, you know, they're faster, they're quicker, and they are a thrill. I mean, a fast quarter horse, there's nothing funner to ride. But the main reason I've quit riding them, it hurts my knees riding quarter horses. They hit the ground harder. I keep my iron shorter to be more comfortable when I ride a quarter horse. So I haven't rode, but maybe two races in the last 2 years of quarter horse races.
So I'm assuming if your very first race was on a quarter horse, then at a young age, you were very good at getting a horse out of the gate.
Yeah, I haven't had any trouble there, so.
Now, tell us, at a young age, starting out, what was it you did struggle with? If there is anything.
You know, I was just so thrilled to get to do it that I really, probably the second year that I rode, I'd grown because I literally weighed like 89, 90 pounds when I started. And then by the time I'd lost the bug, I mean, I was struggling to tack 117 because I didn't understand about how you dieted or where you ate right. And, which now I have zero, you know, I can tack 115. I have no trouble with my weight, but I had a lot of good older riders that helped me. You know, I kept my head on straight and tried to do things right.
What did they teach you specifically about the weight?
Well, the weight part, I think that you just got to learn yourself. I'll tell you, I got hurt real bad in 2010, which, I mean, that's only 8 years ago, and I've rode for 40 years, but at that time, I was off 6 months. I mean, I left the racetrack in a helicopter. I'm very fortunate that I even survived. And but during that time, I learned that drinking water, because a rider, you know, we have to weigh before every race. And, you know, you drink a bottle of water and you've gained a pound. And so I think a lot of riders, you're so dehydrated half the time. And at that time when I was hurt, you know, my body got completely leveled off. My chemistry was right. And I started losing weight by just eating the right things. And my whole system got balanced out because, you know, I flipped as bad as anybody did, which is a bad way to make weight. But that was the way you did it. And there's still riders that do it. You know, they've raised the levels, the scale weights, and it's helped a lot of riders in that aspect. But the young riders right now that I see that are struggling with their weight, I try to tell them, you know, when you're thirsty, you drink water. Don't drink pop. Don't drink Gatorade. Drink water. And your body, it'll learn to flush it out.
How tall are you, Scott?
I'm 5 foot four and a half. At one point, I was 5'6", so I've shrunk. I broke a lot of bones, and I don't know, you know, if I broke my pelvis, I broke my legs, and you know, I don't know if that's what shrunk me, but I've broke about everything you could break.
Mm. Well, and I want to definitely talk about that horrific spill you mentioned that happened in 2010 at Canterbury Park. I read an article, and it's a miracle, as you said, you're even alive, much less you're still riding and having success at it. So tell us, you actually collapsed both of your lungs.
Right, yep. Yeah, it was, I think there was seven of us in the race and only two of them finished. I was in front when it happened, and the filly, she broke both front legs, and then the remaining five of the horses fell over the top of me. And it was a lot. It was, my daughter had just had a baby. Baby was like a month old. And, you know, at first, you know, I went down 100 times probably. Thought the wind was knocked out of me. Well, it wasn't getting any better. And it with the lungs collapsed. And my girlfriend, she lives in Phoenix, and she happened to be there that night. She's a respiratory therapist. She'd run out on the racetrack, and at one point I told her, tell my kids that I love them, that because I thought I was a goner, but. Mm.
And as you mentioned, you were airlifted from the track, and I read that that was the first time that it ever happened at Canterbury Park, so obviously it was just a horrific injury. And
yeah,
when you were going to come back, did you have any doubts?
On it, I think I was in intensive care for 7 days. At that time, you're just trying to figure out what's going to happen, because it literally broke. I asked the doctor, I said, because I'd broke all my ribs, my sternum was broke, both collarbones, and I said, how many ribs are broke? And he's looking at the x-ray, and he says, well, I can tell you there's at least 13, and some of them are in multiple places. Mm. And, but as soon as I start feeling better, then there was no doubt that I was going to ride again. Gary, at the time, was retired. We had some battles on the phone. He told me how crazy I was and that it was stupid. Well, now he's riding again. So he obviously figured it out. That it, this is my job. This is what I do. So.
Well, I think more than that, Scott, every rider I've had on the show, we talk about it, and it's such a love for the game, and it's almost addicting, that thrill you get when you cross the finish line in front. And it's
exactly.
Just, and obviously you have to have such a passion for it, such a love. I mean, if you're out there risking your life, as we just, described a horrific
right.
accident you had, you absolutely have to love what you do.
Yeah, it's, I do. I mean, people ask when are you going to retire? Well, basically I am in retirement mode compared to what, at one time I was riding between 1,100 and I think 1 year I rode 1,500 horses in one year. And, now I've cut it down to where I ride 400 to 500 horses a year. My agent does an excellent job, Chad Anderson, on being selective. I don't like going out there if I'm not on something that's capable of winning, which they're all capable of winning, but it's, he keeps me on live horses. He keeps me on the sound of horses. He does a great job that way. And, when I go out there, I'm going out there to win. So that's how it is.
Now, did you become more selective after that spill at Canterbury?
I think the wear and tear on the body, I've realized that if I ride 4 to 5 races a day with breaks in between, I'm not nearly as wore out and tired when I come back that night. So yeah, it was after that spill. I had my ACL replaced in my left knee in 2008 from another spill at Canterbury. And so that knee, that was the longest I was ever off. I was off 9 months with that injury. This one that was so bad, I actually rode 4.5 months later.
Wow.
I rode back here at Turf Paradise, and he had me on a winner the first one I rode. So
that's impressive. Four and a half months.
Yeah, I don't look the same when I look in the mirror. My chest is, I'm a little deformed. The ribs, because I had no surgeries out of that accident other than the chest tubes that were put in me. But, everything mended without any screws. So I got ribs that aren't where they're supposed to be, but they're healed.
That's what counts. Now, tell us the story. I read, actually, about how you ruptured your ACL, and that's kind of a crazy story in and of itself. Tell us what happened with that.
Well, I rode a horse. I think I'd actually run third on the horse. It was on the turf course at Canterbury, and he pulled this suspensory right past the wire. I got him pulled up about the 7/8 pole on the turf course, and the vet come out. I'd still get upset about the outriders not taking the horse from me, but I held the horse while the vet put the that brace that they put on him, the metal brace, and the straps were tangled up on it. And long story short, the horse ended up stepping down with only the top strap hooked. And when he did, he went to striking, and that thing slid down his leg, and he clocked me in the leg, and that ruptured the AC. I mean, I thought it broke my legs, what it felt like, but it's probably worse than a broken leg. So it was a freak accident, totally freak accident. I wasn't even on the horse when it happened.
And then there was actually an infection after you had that repaired.
Yeah. Probably 2 months later, the thing just kept swelling, and I'd call the doctor, and he'd tell me, take more ibuprofen, you know, and I'm like, this isn't working. Finally, I went in there, and he apologized. He drained, I think, 60 cc's of fluid off of it, told me it was infected, and anyhow, they were able, he thought he was going to have to go in and flush it out, which they would have to surgically go in there, and but they shot antibiotics in it, and it got better, so. But it was 9 months. I was off 9.5 months, I believe, before I rode.
You also broke your pelvis in 6 places, I heard.
Yeah, I broke the pelvis. That one happened at Turf Paradise. I love Canterbury. Absolutely, that's my favorite racetrack, and I've been very successful there. But it seemed from 2008, something happened every year. Rather, 2008 it was the knee. 2010 the deal happened with the bad accident. Then something would happen after I hurt an ankle. Anyhow, the final straw, 2014, I'd run third in the Minnesota Derby, was galloping the horse back, stumbled and fell, and I broke my wrist. And I got 9 screws and a plate in that. And I said, I'm done with this place. Coming back. But I went back every year for at least 3 weeks to a month. So I love it there.
Can't blame you there. That's freak accidents for sure. Now, you mentioned your favorite racetrack. What about your favorite horse?
Man, I got lots of favorite horses. I mean, it's, and I don't care if it's a $3,000 claimer. There's the ones that just love to run, it's they're warriors. They know when they win. People don't really realize that, but they do. They strut their stuff, and they don't want to get beat. They give you all they've got. I really can't name one horse that's my favorite. Every year I got a favorite, I think.
Well, you did have the...
Timeless Prince was one of... It was a horse I rode when I first went to Canterbury in 89, 90. I think I won seven... He won 7 races in a row. And he's still... I got a very special spot for him. When they retired him, he ended up... he was one of the police horses for the Minneapolis Police Department. And he was a pretty special horse. He was a Minnesota bred. Wasn't bred real well, but he beat... I beat Blair's Cove with him that year, which he was a grade one winner, so.
Chucky Scott Stevens joining me tonight on Jonk Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. And Scott, you did get a chance to ride a couple big names, real quiet and great communicator.
Yeah, I can be the only one that says they got beat on a Kentucky Derby winner in Santa Fe, New Mexico. But I knew that he was something special. I can take the thing that I told Baffert to put blinkers on him, because after they put the blinkers on him, he really went to running. So, but at the time I rode him, it was a $500,000 futurity that they run in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I think it was called the Indian Nation Security. And they had trials for it. Flew from Del Mar. I was riding at Del Mar at the time and rode him in the trials and ran third, and then he ran third in the finals. And then I did get to ride him in a maiden race at Del Mar. I think he ran fourth that day, and that's when I told him he needed the blinker. So. But great communicator. He was a very special horse to me. That was when I first went to California, and that Ackle had him, that had just come from the fairgrounds, told me he had a horse that they wanted me to ride and needed to take him off the pace. And I think at that time, the horse might have been in for like $20,000. Well, I fought hard trying to get him back, and he ended up, he run third. And I told him when I come back, he said, man, if we would have just let him go to the lead, I think he'd win. Anyhow, that's how his style ended up being. And the way I lost the horse, I was supposed to ride him in the, it was a big turf stakes at Louisiana Downs they were taking him to. And I actually got hurt the night before riding a horse at Pomona. I went down, and the rest is history. Mm. That horse could carry his speed further than any horse I ever rode. He could put him in a drive for 5/8 of a mile, and he'd still finish.
You're right about both horses. Real quiet and great communicator. Worked out well for them. Now, Scott, I remember when I would get hurt and I would watch the races on TV, and horses I would, you know, was supposed to be riding would go and win. And so I can't imagine how you felt watching Great Communicator. I mean, that for me was the most frustrating part of riding.
The thing about Great Communicator, you know, that year I think he ran third in the race at Louisiana, then he ran third or fourth in the DC International that year. And then it was the following year when Sabil started riding that he really got good. So, you know, I was glad for all parties, because at the time I had left California, I wasn't even riding there. So, you know, that was a good story. It was good for Ray and it was good for Thad. So
you were happy for them, but
yeah, I was. Yeah, I've never, you know, in this business, it's like being mad at somebody, you know, you're only hurting yourself, you know, and I've been hurt so much now that if I got upset every time one of them won while I was hurt, you know, I do stay involved. Even when I'm hurt, I watch the results, I stay in touch with my trainers, and so when I'm ready to ride, I'm back in action. And, you know, it takes a while to get some of your horses back, but you do.
Well, folks, we will continue our visit with jockey Scott Stevens after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Hi, I'm John Velasquez.
And I'm Julian Lepau. Every jockey knows and accepts the risk of a sport every time they get a leg up on the horse.
Although catastrophic on-track accidents are rare, when they do happen, the lives of the jockeys and their family change forever.
It's up to all of us in racing to support these men and women.
That's why we support the Permanent Disabled Jockey Fund. Since its founding in 2006, the PDJF has disbursed over $8 million to over 75 permanently disabled jockeys.
Over 90 cents out of every dollar donated goes directly to these brave men and women.
They use their monthly stipend to pay bills, hire caretakers, and many other things that make living with a permanent disability just a bit easier.
This is Mike Penna of HRRN. Did you know that the PDJF has no permanent guaranteed funding mechanism and relies entirely on donations from people like you? Please visit the PDJF website at pdjf.org to learn how you can help.
Hi, I'm Ron Turcotte. I support the PDJF. I hope you will too, and I thank you.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigle, and I am joined this evening by jockey Scott Stevens. So, Scott, during the first half of the show, you mentioned your kids a couple of times. Yeah. So tell us about your family.
I have a son and a daughter. They've That's how I ended up in Phoenix, basically. When they started school, I wasn't going to move them from one school to another. And the Turf Paradise season lasted about exactly the school year. So I wouldn't have changed anything. You know, I may have been able to make more money somewhere else, but my kids, they went to the same school all through high school, and they're grown up now. I think my son's 31, my daughter's 32. She has two girls and a boy, and my son just had his first child. It's 3 months old. So then my girlfriend, her daughter has a 14-year-old. So I've got 5 grandkids.
Wow, that's awesome. Do you get to see them often?
My son lives here, so I get to see the baby and I get to see the 14-year-old. My daughter lives in Scappoose, Oregon, which I get to see her about twice a year. She usually comes for Christmas, and then I go there in the summertime. I'm hoping she'll move back sometime, but she has a good family and a good husband, and they like it there.
Did they ever have any desire to get involved with the racetrack?
They don't, and my son will come. If I, you know, ride a stakes or something, he'll come out. I mean, they watch how I do, but they've never, my daughter took riding lessons. She knows how to ride. My son, I don't know if he's ever even been on a horse, but that don't bother me at all. It's, they get to do their own thing. And I see these girls that ride and I don't know if I'd want my daughter being a jockey, put it that way. Because I know the things that I've went through, you know, I can't imagine her going through it. I don't know why I'm that way, but it's, they do a great job, but I wouldn't want my daughter going through some of the pain that I've went through.
And what do they do?
My daughter just takes care of the kids. And my son, he worked for Barbecue Galore for 5 years, and he's just switched up. He works in an electrical company. And he does site and graphic design, computer graphic design, different websites. He's actually he's designed the CD album covers for a couple bands. He was a rock star there for a while, so.
Now, do you think, having watched you go through all of the injuries and the ups and downs of the sport, do you think that maybe deterred them from?
Yeah, maybe. When my dad was training here at Turf Paradise, my son actually, he cleaned stalls for him, you know, when he was like 12, 13 years old. So he was around it, but he's got too big. He probably weighs 160, 170 pounds now. So I don't know. I think that's one thing that the racetracks need to do is try to get the younger generation involved in racing from owning horses to the gambling, which that's something that I see happening at Canterbury Park. They do an excellent job of getting the young crowd. On Thursday nights, it's Buck Night, and they'll have 7,000 to 10,000 people at the races, and it's a younger generation, which we don't see here at Turf Paradise.
That's incredible that they get such a great number at, you know, what you would consider a smaller racetrack.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a fun crowd. You know, they do an excellent job.
Yeah, I completely agree with you that more racetracks need to do something similar. And why do you think it is that they don't? Have they just not figured it out yet?
I don't think they figured it out. I really don't. You know, I think Canterbury was the first one that got involved in having the group partnerships where the fans can get involved in owning a horse. I think several racetracks are doing it now. But they have a Canterbury Club where everybody puts in $400. There may be up to 200, 300 people that own a horse, but you know, you get them involved. They're not losing a lot of money. You know, they're initial and they got a chance and they learn what it's like to own a horse. Go to the paddock, go to the barns.
I know the Churchill Downs has the similar thing. They call it the Churchill Downs Racing Club. And I think that is fantastic. People who, you know, it's I guess, not really an easily accessible sport. It's hard to really get contacts and learn more about the sport. So I think it is such a great thing that they do. Yeah. That's a start anyway.
Right. Yeah.
Now, what else have you seen throughout the years, good or bad, that's changed in racing?
As the jockey aspect, this whip rule that they're coming up with, they got it in California. They had it in Minnesota. I do not agree with it, where you can only hit them three times and you got to give them a couple strikes. Because I'm not a person that beats on a horse. I don't ride that way. The 14th horse I rode at Canterbury this summer, I got nailed 200 for hitting it four times. I run second in the race. I believe if I would have quit whipping it, I would have got beat for second. You know, my feeling is if the stewards have enough power to disqualify a horse, they have enough power to decide if you're abusing one. You know, we went to the cushion poppers where, you know, we're not trying to hurt the horse by any means. But you got to do something to try to persuade them to keep running. And, you know, I think if somebody's wailing on one, cutting them in the flanks, you go ahead and fine them. But I don't agree with the whip rule. It's, you know, I understand why they have it, but I also understand that if somebody's abusing a horse, you fine them. But you can't go by, when you've got two horses nose and nose to the wire and one guy's going to get fined $400 if he whips the horse too many times, because it starts out, it's a $200 fine, then a $400, then a $6, and then they give you 3 days. Mm. So I don't like that rule. That's one aspect that.
I completely agree with you there, Scott. I was fortunate enough I didn't have to deal with it when I rode,
right.
But I can't imagine you're riding to the wire. Like you said, you're in a stretch duel and you have to count how many times you're hitting a horse. I'm sure I wouldn't have.
I ended up the next 3 weeks that I rode there, you know, I'm thinking about it. And that's something you shouldn't have to think about. You know, you're trying to win a race, and now all of a sudden you know your focus isn't, you obviously, if your mind's thinking about it, your focus is also off of riding for a minute and counting how many times you hit the thing. I mean, you learn in, you know, after being there for the 3 weeks, I got into a rhythm of doing it the right way, but still in the heat of the battle, you shouldn't have to think about it.
Jockey Scott Stevens joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Sorry, Scott, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Oh, that's all right. I just don't, you know, and I don't think that the bettors are aware of it. You know, the guy quit hitting a horse, you know. If they're going to find us, let the public know that the reason he wasn't whipping the horse at the wire is because he's going to get fined if he hit it again.
Yeah, I agree. It's a pretty ridiculous rule. Seems to me like it's just a matter of common sense. You know, if you're getting run out of a horse and you're riding to the wire, and again, you're trying to get every ounce of run out of the horse versus someone who's just, you know, beating a horse. It's basically a dead
and
horse.
And you rode, you know that there's certain horses, you get a couple lengths in front, they get out there by themselves, they start looking at the grandstands, they... You know, and they will slow down, and you're not trying to hurt them, but you're trying to keep their attention enough that they stay focused to run to the wire. And you get one falling asleep, and they can get nailed by something closing. So,
well, Scott, I want to talk a little bit about an interesting story I read, and I'm sure you weren't really thinking about the whip rule when this happened. You were riding a horse, and the blinkers were falling off.
Oh, yeah. Unstoppable Kobe. That, people asked me, they said, you know, how did you, you know, that was self-preservation. When you see that it's going up, I seen him come in hooked. It was the race, it was muddy here. And I think the race was three quarters. We'd win down the backside, and I was head-to-head with another horse as we went into the turn, and I seen him lift up, and then they are literally over his eyes. So, I was able to reach up, and I pulled him off. I pulled him back over I ended up pulling the whole brow band come off of his ears, I kept him in my hand. I didn't throw him out. I'm glad I didn't do that, because then I might have got... the horse did come back and win the race. So, yeah, that's one of those horses that we were talking earlier, though. He was such a fighter and a trier. He did not want horses to go by him. Unstoppable coat.
Did they put the blinkers back on him next out?
Yeah, they did. He did.
Well, kind of an interesting race. I can't imagine.
That was interesting.
Now let's talk about your relationship with Gary, and especially in the beginning when you were both riding together all of the time. What was that like? I'm sure you had to be just extremely competitive with each other.
I think he was more competitive with me than I was with him, because I wanted him to do. He had so much natural ability, because we both grew up around the horses, but I was on a horse a lot more than he was at a younger age. He really didn't pick up the complete interest in it until I started riding, which I think at the time he was 12 years old. And then he seen I was making money and the interest, he was small when he first started, I tried to get him on live horses, and we had a lot of fun together. He rode in Boise for, I think, the first 2 years he rode. He rode for the 3 months and then went back to school. And then the following year, he went to California with Chuck Taliaferro. And he stayed, I think he was there about 3 months, and then he come in and rode the end of the Boise meet. Did real well, and then the next year he says, I don't know if it's true, he says the reason that he left Boise was he wanted to be a leading rider somewhere, and he was never going to beat me. So he went to Washington, and the best move he ever made, it was, because he did very successful at Long Acres and then on to California. But we still have a very good relationship. We talk some, we may go a couple weeks without talking, and then we may talk every day for a week. So I've talked to him, I think, 3 times this week.
I know I've heard him say before that you're someone he looks up to, someone he seeks constructive criticism from.
Yeah, I mean, we both aren't afraid to tell each other what we think, whether it's just relax, you're trying too hard, or, it's a crazy business. No matter what kind of success you've had in the past, if you're not winning races, then they're not looking for you. They want people that are winning. They don't look and see what kind of horses you've been riding. But, so it's a tough business. It's a very tough business.
Scott, if you had a young rider come up to you today asking for advice, what's the most important thing you would tell them?
I think the biggest thing is to never forget where you come from. You've got to realize how much work goes into those horses, and you just got to try every time. And if you make a mistake, don't dwell on it. You learn from it. You learn from your mistakes. I still am learning things every day. There's things that you learn out there. You ride a race and figure out that next time I'll do this different with this horse. And I'll try to help any young rider that I can if they want to listen. If they don't, then, they're on their own. But there's so many ups and downs in this business.
How long do you plan on riding?
I don't put a date on it. It's as long as I'm having fun and feel like I'm still helping the horse, I'm going to keep riding.
Good answer. And
I mean, if it could end tomorrow, there'll be a day when I don't feel like doing it anymore, but not, I'm this meet's getting ready to start on October 13th, and I'm ready to roll.
When that date does come, hopefully many, many, many years from now, what do you plan on doing after riding?
I've been asked that. You know, he only had three horses here. It's been, I think it was in 2013 or 14. Anyhow, my mom was still in Idaho, and Dad had only been here for a couple of days, and my mom had a stroke, and my dad had to go home and left me with the two horses, and I got rid of one of them right off the bat, but I ended up training the other one through the Turf Paradise meet. Me and my girlfriend were doing it, and you know, I enjoyed it, but I also, you know, it's 7 days a week, 24 hours a day being a trainer. To where jockey, you know, we can take a day off. So I don't know if I would love to train, but I would almost rather have my own horses than have to deal with all the politics on the side. So I really don't know what I would do. It's, you know, I'm pretty content doing anything. You know, I've got friends that have quit riding and they become gallop boys. They work on the gate. You know, there's so much that I can do. You know, I've been asked, why don't you go to steward school? I would love to do the aspect of the stewards of watching the races and doing that part of it. But as far as the medication and the licensing and the trainers, getting the bad tests, you know, I don't want to deal with all that. So I don't know. There's things to do.
What goals do you still hope to accomplish as a rider?
You know, every meet that starts, you know, I put a goal out there to try to win a race a day. You know, if that ends up making me leading rider at the end of the meet, I did good regardless. So that's the goals I set. It, you know, I'm not going to say I'm not going to try to be leading rider at Turf Paradise when we start. But that's the goal I have. Other than that, I would like to get to 5,000 thoroughbred wins. I would like to do that. I could see that happening, so.
How was it when you won your 4,000th race? You won that in actually at Turf Paradise, I read.
Yeah, I got two pictures on here showing my 4,000th wins. They counted it at one point at Canterbury. They counted all of the turn races I'd rode, which included 870 races and some of the appies that I rode in California. So that one was actually, what's the date on this one? August 9th of 2009. I mean, it was a thrill both times. It's you know, that's a lot of races. I never dreamed I'd win that many.
It's a big number. So it's 5,000.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You're right around the corner from that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about, I mentioned in the introduction, your two graded stakes victories, the Manitoba Derby, the Grade 3 Manitoba in 2003. You won aboard Hero's Pleasure, and then you also won the Grade 3 Phoenix Gold Cup in 97 with Rots of Luck.
Yeah.
Which one of those do you cherish the most?
You know, both of them were. Rots of Luck, that was... He was an old campaigner that Vladimir Serin had. You know, that, like I've won the Gold Cup, I think, two more times here. They've taken the grade off of it, but it's still, it's, you know, it's the most prestigious race they got at Turf Paradise. So it's still, you know, that's the race you try to win every year. The Manitoba Derby, I've been fortunate. I think I've rode in it four times. I've won it two more times since then. But, you know, and that's their biggest race. So it's, you know, a win's a win, a stakes no matter what the purse is. I know how much work goes into the horses, and you know, they're running with the best that's at that track. So whether it's graded or not, a stakes win's a stakes win.
Do you remember how the race was run, each one of those?
The Manitoba Derby, I remember that one was Doug Oliver's horse, and he'd went from he was running at Canterbury, and they hauled him up there and run him. And I'd started with him as a two-year-old here in Phoenix. So that was a thrill for him because he ended up running on the turf real well after that. And he was kind of a knothead to ride. He tried to get out real bad, and he got it all together that day at Winnipeg and made a good move down the stretch and got her done. And lots of luck. I'd taken off a couple horses to ride him, and people thought I was nuts. I'm riding a horse that had been off a year's layoff. But he ended up, I think when he retired, he won about 18 races. He was just a good old hard-knocking horse.
He proved them wrong that day. What did he pay that day? Do you remember?
He ended up going off one of the favorites because he had good back class on his form. But
Jockey Scott Stevens joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Scott, I want to talk about something that is pretty evident with your career. You've moved around a lot. And especially early on in your career, as you mentioned, when you had your kids, you pretty much stayed there in Phoenix. But what is that like? Describe that to the audience, that kind of gypsy lifestyle.
I think you got it right. We're like a carnival. And one of the funnest summers that I probably had in my career was I was going through a divorce in 1999. And me and my son, we bought an RV, and I went and rode on the California Fairs, where you actually are moving every 2 weeks. And that was one of the funnest summers that I had riding, because you're still seeing the same people, but you're seeing new places. And the one thing I do regret through all of my moving in my career was you took a day and a half to get from Phoenix to Minnesota, and you don't stop and see the scenery on the way. And since then, which unfortunately my kids aren't with me now on these trips, but I take my time and I'll go tour the South Dakota or go see different scenes on the way. I don't hurry as much as I used to. I'm still in a hurry to get there, but I take my time. But the lifestyle, no matter which racetrack you go to, whether I go from here to Hot Springs or Louisiana Downs, there's always somebody there that.
It's a small world, Scott. Now, did you ever travel out east at all?
Now, I actually, probably one of the biggest thrills I had as a rider, I rode a horse named Broadway Empire. I believe it was in 2014. In the Metropolitan Mile, I think that's the biggest race I've rode in, the 1.2 million. It was the year that California Chrome was going for the Triple Crown at Belmont. And I was in front till the eighth pole, so that was a thrill. I ended up, I think he ran fifth. But that's the only time I rode in New York. I rode a couple races. I rode the Florida Stallion Stakes at Calder. When I first went to California, I went and rode the Bashford Manor Stakes and the Debutante at Churchill for Lucas. I ran second in both of those races. That's the only time I rode at Churchill. But Louisiana Downs, I spent a summer there. Hot Springs, I rode there two winters. But that's about as far east as I got, and that's still classified the Midwest, I guess. I rode at Remington, so.
A lot of traveling there, Scott. You said,
yeah.
So of everywhere you've been, you said Canterbury is your favorite.
Yes.
And why
all
is that?
All aspects of it. I like the people there. I like the, I'm from Idaho, where I'm used to green grass and farmland, and that, you have that in Minnesota, which, Phoenix, we're in the desert. I do have a backyard. I have grass in my backyard, which a lot of people don't, but it's, I don't know. It's Canterbury, it was built by Santa Anita when they built it. It's a first-class place. They take care of it. The barn area is nice. It's just, it's a good place to spend the summer.
Well, Scott, we only have a minute left here, but you said the meet starts up there at Turf Paradise on the 13th. And I guess you're gearing up for that. What are you looking forward to? You have any nice horses coming up?
Yeah, I rode a real nice filly, which I can't even think of her name. She's a Medaglia d'Oro filly of Sean Davis's that I rode at Canterbury. I went on her both times, and I'm thinking she's going to have a real good meet here at Turf Paradise. And then Molly Pearson, she's had her string in California. She brings him back over here, and Robertino Diodoro has been the leading trainer here the last 4 or 5 years, and I rode one horse for him the whole meet last year. So I write for a lot of the smaller barns, but, you know, they all have a horse in their barn that's keeping them there, and I try to get on it on the day that it's going to win. So I'm just looking forward. It's a long meet. We run all the way till the first week of May, so a lot can happen in that amount of time.
Well, Scott, we are all out of time, but thank you so much for joining us and wishing you all the best.
Thank you.
Folks, you can check out this show and replays of all of our other shows on the website at horseracingradio.net. While you're there, check out all of the other great shows you can find here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.